Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. We're back with Our Thoughts Tonight. I'm Ishik, joined by Murat and Sean. And hello. Everybody say hi.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back.
Good evening.
All right. So if you guys were here for last night, we were talking about five values that are very special to us as humans. We talked about compassion, we talked about romance, and we talked about pride. We didn't get through the list completely. So for tonight, we're going to finish off the list. We're going to add a new value as well. So we're going to talk about community, justice, and faith. But before we get into any of that, as always, crucem sanctum.
Crucem sanctum.
Crucem sanctam subit.
How's everyone doing this evening?
Fine.
Fine. All right.
Peachy.
We're back. Round two.
Round two.
Five values.
Five values. I suppose round four for the fourth value, but
Where did we start yesterday? Let's do a quick recap. Maybe we did.
Yeah. So we talked about compassion, and oh man, I don't want to go back through each value, but
no.
Yeah, we went. Yeah, we talked about, for example, the whether you know. Compassion's ability to be more innate or Maybe it's just it's a fancy way of lust or whatever. That also went for romance, actually, now that I remember. We also talked about pride a little bit. We talked about how pride isn't overall a bad thing and how it might be the most innate of all feelings. We talked about its connections with the devil in Christianity. We also talked a little bit about communication and an audience and speaker's responsibility. We had Bailey call in last night, so we answered her question about that. But for now, we have a new value to tackle: community. And this is a weird value because it's more of just a noun than a value. But So I think overall this is probably going to be the easiest one. But where do you guys think? How important is community to an individual human? Where does it come from, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I actually have a little bit of a definition here, okay, which I think is a good place to start. A community consists of a unified body of individuals with a common interest in a specific area. A community can refer to an entire city, a neighborhood in a city, or a small town, as well as a group within a city. For instance, what immediately comes to mind when I say a group within a city is the early canonical and apocryphal letters of the New Testament, or actually if they're apocryphal, they're not in the New Testament, but addressed to the Christian communities in different cities, right? They oftentimes use the term to the church in Edessa or the church in Corinth, but they meant, because they had no churches then as we have today. But it would be the church would be the community of Christians in that city.
I think that little part of the definition where directed towards a common interest is pretty important, I think, because for example, the wider you have your lens on a community, that interest becomes wider and wider, but perhaps more essential and more essential. I was thinking about, like, for example, like, let's say climate change, you know, for example, an issue to tackle. That issue, although it affects groups locally, it's much more important on a global scale. So viewing it as a global community is, it seems a little bit interesting that particular issue becomes more specific the larger you go out. But yeah, so for example, with community, do you think it's, how should I say it? How intrinsic do you think community is to a person? I guess we're both of you that way.
I think it's pretty natural. Just like every time we start to talk about every one of these values, the first thing I think is immediately I can tie it to some sort of evolutionary as an evolutionary necessity. And community seems to be like a big one when it comes to evolution, because, you know, the having to stick together to survive type of mentality, it's just kind of stuck. And also now we seem to attribute that sense of community to the most arbitrary things, such as sports and politics. You know, there's always us and them type of mentality, which I think will always be around because it's innate.
That's interesting you bring that up, because the weirdest connection as made with what you just said is like, I haven't brought Ted Kaczynski up in the podcast for a long time with the Unabomber, but in the manifesto, it talks about how there are, you know, the more natural obligations, the more natural needs, like, you know, shelter or whatever, the more tribalistic sense. And then there are the surrogate activities, which have replaced those, you know, basically the quest for food has become the quest for a job or whatever.
Right.
And it's funny in that sense how a community in its origin can be traced back to the family unit and later the village unit and then the town unit, the city unit. And now it's more of a, we view it, even if it's literal or not, we view it in a sense of the surrogate activities in a sort of interest community,
mm-hmm.
instead of an actual survival community. Although the survival community is important and it does exist.
I don't think it's as necessary, so that it gets sublimated because it's not as integral to survival.
It's not as obvious, at least. Yeah.
Well, Murat said survival, and I think that's part of it. But I think also just our hard wiring as social creatures, that community becomes essential. I mean, we think of, in the situation we're in right now with the lockdown of COVID, I mean, a lot of people are going a little bit stir crazy because they can't have the community except through Zoom or telephone, or, you know, they can't gather like they used to in communities.
Yeah.
And it's also like why many people can't follow the restrictions or can't follow
social. You think that's why?
I think that's a big part of it. They just, it's hard. It's just overall hard. I think there's a lot of other reasons why people don't, you know, self-distance. It's but I would bet that it's just, it's not natural for them to just isolate themselves.
Yeah.
Well, if we're a social creature like so many others, like chimps,
yeah.
Dolphins, caribou, then not having that community would really hurt you psychologically.
Yeah.
And I can see depression very, very easily mm-hmm. for the lack of that.
I felt, when we had the quarantine, in like the 5 weeks, I mean, some people have still been quarantining, obviously, but the 5 weeks where we had no work or anything, that complete lockdown, I was feeling depressed, and I couldn't put my finger on why. It didn't feel like it was because we were suddenly, you know, we went from 100 miles an hour to everything being normal to suddenly lockdown. Now, I guess we've kind of acclimated. But then I remember the first 2 weeks, I would just sit there and like be confused almost and feel depressed, even though I was fine on some level. But on one level, I could tell that there was something that didn't feel right. Something, I mean, it was such a sudden shift for me, not being at work, you know, 12 hours a day, that it was jarring, I think. But I got used to it and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because I mostly do enjoy isolation, but like,
yeah, same here.
Yeah, but it was weird because
it's almost excessive.
Yeah, yeah. Because like for example, like you might have had those days where you actually don't, like, you actually want to socialize, like, mm-hmm. you know, you feel like energized, and it's like, well, what am I going to use this on? What am I going to use the energy I have on?
Yeah.
You know, it's like work, to work.
There's been a huge influx in podcasts and YouTube channels and on e-commerce and anything online that is almost, I guess e-commerce isn't really community based, but YouTube channels, like live streams on YouTube. And like what we're doing here has definitely been, you know, accelerating in terms of how many people are doing it.
Yeah.
And I think it goes also back to what you said about the formation of hamlets, villages, you know, mm-hmm. the hunter-gathering unit, the first cities. Obviously, they were largely organized, or they came together. It wasn't anybody said, you know, we're going to organize this way. They just sort of naturally came together. And that's part of that social instinct. And if you look in history, you think how much pride people still take in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But the first cities, I mean, you could think of mythological and legendary cities or historical cities that were essential for the human psyche. Like take the Greek polis, right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the Greek associated himself with the polis.
Yeah.
Right? He wasn't.
There was no Greece. Greece.
No Greece. It was just a series of cities.
Yeah.
Right? The city-states.
Yeah.
What they would call just the polis, the city. And as well, there's a number of Anglo-Saxon poems. One's called The Wanderer. It's a little bit too long and involved to read, but it's first person, and it's a person who no longer, a warrior who no longer has a meat hall, no longer has a community. And it's a very depressing poem as he dwells on his loneliness and not having friends, not having comrades. Another one, The Seafarer, is the same way. And that sense of loss without community that the mm-hmm. individual can go through. Right? But on the other hand, you have the first major, I might read an excerpt from this at one point, but the first major piece of literature, and I'm saying literature in the written language, because there was a lot of record keeping and tax keeping and stuff like this. But the first real bestseller in literature was The Epic of Gilgamesh. And that opens with the city, Uruk. Think of the Rome as the center for them. Athens, Jerusalem, Peking, you know, all these cities gave a sense of community.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's you can't go anywhere without in the world without seeing at the community, even nomadic tribes or whatever. There's still community. It might not be the city, but I mean, that goes so far back, like before even just the idea of a human, like when we're just chimps in the, well, not chimps technically, but you know, when we're just apes in the trees, you know, even that is this, you know, even that's a community. We weren't like lone hunters in the wild. We were family units, you know, scavenging for food up in trees. Like that's, you know, it's so far back.
Well, even primates, they have not just a family group, but they have an extended family group,
yeah.
Cousins, you know, aunts and uncles. Yeah. And yeah, their family group was very huge, their social group.
And the thing with community is like, there's so many other values that stem from it. Like the idea of a leader, right? A silverback gorilla or whatever, right? Or that you have a king or whatever. It like you can't have ideas of leadership. You can't have ideas of what?
Gorillas.
What?
Bananas.
Banana peel.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Gorillas eat bananas, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, they are vegetarian.
Yeah. They need food somehow. But yeah, like you can't have ideas of leadership. You can't have ideas of equal roles. You can't have ideas of like many of the ideas, like we talked about compassion and romance and maybe not pride, but at least those first two, you can't really have those without a sense of community to a certain extent. So it's really far back. The one weird question I have, which it was a question I had a long time ago, maybe a year ago at this point. I probably mentioned it to both of you. And I don't remember the exact way it goes, but it's basically the fundamental problem with it, though. Basically, it's we do have a very deep sense of community and, you know, connection with other people. But the mere fact that we exist as individuals, I think there is a really weird paradox there. And it might be miscategorized in the different questions or different categories of how you view those things, like community and the self. But like, it's very weird that as individual creatures, we yearn for other individual creatures. And I think it seems a little bit, I feel there's a sort of paradox there where we at the end of the day, we strive, like for example, we were talking about pride, right? At the end of the day, we strive for our own betterments, but there is still that community. And I think that's really, it might be the source of a lot of problems. It's just, it's a really weird mixture there, you know?
Do you remember that Far Side comic? I think it was Far Side, where it's a single frame comic. And what you're looking at is just, I don't know what penguins are called in the group, but just hundreds and hundreds of penguins, right?
Yeah.
And there's a bubble, a verbal bubble above this mass of penguins. And in the bubble is the song, I just gotta be me,
yeah.
Right? So that's striving, the need for the group, but yeah, the paradox of also wanting to establish individuality in that group.
Yeah. And, you know, to go, I suppose, a little religious with this, like, let's take a Buddhist perspective on this. So I'm sure I mentioned a little bit, like I like Madhyamaka Buddhism a lot. And a whole part of that is the idea of what's the word I use? Of how everything is dependent on each other, basically. And when you have complete dependence, you have no self, basically. Where your entire existence and your entire reality is based off of every other thing. So at the end of the day, it's a whole mix and match of just conditions, the whole mix and match of just connections and stuff. Where basically, if you were to adopt that view in this paradoxical question, it would be like, well, the community value has more power than the self. At least in that perspective, I would say.
So let me ask a question extending the idea of Buddhism. I'm gonna switch it a little bit to Hinduism.
Yes.
So, and it's a wholly hypothetical question. So the goal in Hinduism is to become one with the Atman. So
the Brahman.
The Brahman.
Yeah.
Right. Once you, that's a community in itself, becoming one with the Brahman. And at that point, the individual disappears. The ego, or the individual ego, I should say, disappears. Is that a sense of community, and does that totally disrupt?
See, that's really weird. That's really hard, because at the end of the day, government is one.
Yes.
Right? But it's also, again, a community.
Right.
So so I remember, this is very much the answer I think you gave, or one of you gave, when I asked that question about a year ago, or was sort of solution to it. It's we were talking about it. There is community, but if you do a social lens or whatever, an easier answer, if you're going mystical, is we're all one. You can have that individual sense. We can also have the communal sense. And I suppose if you want to go with Hinduism or maybe some other Gnostic beliefs or whatever, at the end of the day, it's a sort of unifying whole once you realize we're all one. That way, I suppose a pride is somewhat fulfilled, as there is just one, and that is just us. If that makes any sense.
Well, if you're one with the Atman, there's no pride.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
But if you're in a human group, like the Reich, or even a member of a church, pride still plays a role.
That's very interesting. It's like to pride being a factor when a community isn't properly realized or properly fulfilled. Like a pride is established in a sort of a tribalistic sense of community. But if we're going the spiritual sense of community, it's beyond that, at least in the Hinduistic sense.
Well, it only depends if the pride is excessive, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, what can take pride in belonging to a church or a faith?
Yeah. Did you have a poem about community, Sean?
I actually do. I have two potential ones.
All right.
Let me read one. This one gets back to the idea of the individual without a community. Okay.
Excellent.
Isolated. It's called Mr. Flood's Party by Edward Arlington Robinson, who was born in 1869 and died in 1935. A lot of people, I remember teaching this in a number of classes, and students often take it as a polemic against drinking. But it's really not if you think about the last two lines. Mr. Flood is living alone, and he's basically outlived his community. Mr. Flood's Party. Old Evan Flood, climbing alone one night over the hill between the town below and the forsaken upland hermitage that held as much as he should ever know on earth again of home, paused warily. The road was his when not a neighbor near, and Eben, having leisure, said aloud, for no man else in Tilbury town to hear, "Well, Mr. Flood, we have the harvest moon again, and we may not have many more. The bird is on the wing, the poet says, and you and I have said it here before. Drink to the bird." He raised up to the light the jug that he had gone so far to fill, and answered huskily, "Well, Mr. Flood, since you propose it, I believe I will." Alone, as if enduring to the end, the valiant armor of scarred hopes outworn, stood there in the middle of the road, like Roland's ghost, winding a silent horn. Below him, in the town, among the trees, where friends of other days had honored him, a phantom salutation of the dead rang thinly, till old Eben's eyes were dim. Then, as a mother lays her sleeping child down tenderly, fearing it may awake, he set the jug down slowly at his feet with trembling care, knowing that most things break. And only when assured that on firm earth it stood, as the uncertain lives of men assuredly did not, he paced away and with his hand extended paused again. "Well, Mr. Flood, we have not met like this in a long time, and many a change has come to both of us, I fear, since last it was we had a drop together. Welcome home." Convivially returning with himself, again he raised the jug up to the light, and with an acquiescent quaver said, "Well, Mr. Flood, if you insist, I might." "Only a very little, Mr. Flood, for auld lang syne." "No more, sir. That will do." And so for the time, apparently it did. And Eben evidently thought so too. For soon amid the silver loneliness of the night, he lifted up his voice and sang, secure, with only two moons listening, until the whole harmonious landscape rang. For auld lang syne, the weary throat gave out, the last word wavered, and the song being done, he raised again the jug regretfully, and shook his head, and was again alone. There was not much that was ahead of him, and there was nothing in the town below. Strangers would have shut the many doors that many friends had opened long ago.
Hi, my name is Wasabi Blues, and I'm the host of my podcast called Just a Thought. If you're a fan of music and you'd like to hear the perspective and thoughts from an artist and audio engineer on various topics within the music industry related to artists, songs, or whatever it may be, I recommend you check us out. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or your preferred place for listening to podcasts. Again, my name is Wasabi Blues, and my podcast is called Just a Thought.
That was the Dominican Sisters of the Fikirmont.
That's kind of a banger. I don't know. Isn't there a next song also by them? Or?
Oh, no. The next one is... I can't remember who it's by, but I'll give you the name. Hallelujah Pasha Nostrum.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a real toe tapper.
Yeah, definitely.
It'll never beat Praise the Lord Three Times.
Oh, Praise the Lord Three Times.
Not four, yeah, not right. Two, but three.
That's the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, right?
Yeah. We should revisit that later.
Yeah, we should do that series on them again.
Yeah.
Revisited.
I have an episode on the Insoluble Organum and another one on the Bulgarian.
We should do an episode where we just listen to a chant, like how we used to. Listen to the chant analysis. Listen to a chant analysis.
We should do that. Yeah. Well, if we're going to do that, we should revisit those old ones then. We should get a new one. Yeah.
Or even classical pieces we could
do. Too, yeah.
That would be fun.
I kind of want to listen explore more of this Dominican Sister stuff, though.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so we're on to our next value. So we've gone through compassion, romance, pride, and community. And now we got justice. So I think right now Sean has a definition of justice before we proceed, right?
I do. Okay, so justice, the maintenance or administration of what is just or right, by the impartial judgment of conflicting claims and the rewards or punishments for proper words and deeds, or acceptable words and deeds.
That leaves so much room for subjectivity.
Doesn't it ever?
It's just like...
but you need a general term, you know, some general understanding what the word means.
Yeah. I mean, that connects with like our whole ethics episode, like by what standards are you going to go, you know, judge or, you know, use justice, for example, like, you know, utilitarian sense or deontological sense or a relativist sense, like how the hell are you going to implement justice as fairly as possible? But, you know, that's for the law degrees.
Well,
you could start
with justice as many different denominations view justice.
I think mainly, I'd say the most modern use, or I don't want to say modern, most common contemporary use of justice is in a utilitarian manner.
Yeah, that's fair, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, utilitarians are mostly made fun of because if you like the whole fallacy, reductio ad absurd, ad absurdum, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you use that fallacy in a utilitarian, it becomes hilarious. But yeah, I mean, overall, that makes the most sense. But yeah, I mean, that's right. Well, I mean, in a certain case, yes, but like, we still have punishments for theft and death or murder and whatnot. And those are ultimately deeds that are bad, considered by like a Kantian guy or a deontologist or a deontological guy or whatever.
And that goes back to the first clause in this, the maintenance or administration of what is just or right.
Yeah.
So strictly utilitarian, especially by the impartial judgment.
Well,
right. Well, if I go to court, hopefully I have an impartial judge.
Yeah.
But I'm being judged on whether I did right or wrong, getting back to community, whether I did any wrong for the community, to the community.
I've got a great quote by, what's his name, Jeremy Bentham, I believe.
He's the
father of modern utilitarianism. That might kind of put some...
Dad!
What's that?
The father of utilitarianism.
Yeah. I think it might add something to the conversation, but... I guess it's in terms of utilitarianism, the end may justify the means as long as there is something that justifies the end. And I guess in terms of morality and politics and justice, that kind of makes sense.
I mean, applicable to a lot of the situations out there, but in a sense of, like, for example, we still have laws that are based on, I suppose, like fundamental values kind of thing, kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum, where instead of saying the right and wrong is determined by the utility of what has happened, but more so the actual value of what you did, like killing someone or stealing something or something like that.
Yeah. Well, then you get into the your buddy Hammurabi. the code.
Yeah. Well, I would say the Hammurabi is much more. Actually, I don't know. That's a very good question. Would Hammurabi's codes be more utilitarian or deontological?
I definitely don't think they're definitely deontological because of the mala in se is the Latin expression for just bad in nature, which is very deontological, where you know you're just going off of you know this moral sense of right or wrong without any objectiveness like utilitarianism.
So should we differentiate, you think, between the law and justice? For instance, you can bring up the Ten Commandments, okay? Those are laws, mm-hmm. according to both the Hebrew, the Christian. How about the Muslim religion? Do they adhere to the Ten Commandments?
Not necessarily, but most of them are agreeable either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you have laws there. But if somebody transgresses one of those laws, that's justice, how you deal with that transgressor. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You have the law and you have how you deal with the transgressor of law.
Yeah, well, in that sense, going back to Hammurabi's code, right, I don't know if it's actually deontological, because although it does state that, you know, like, you know, taking an eye is wrong, the response is the same thing, you know, at least in a surface level thing, an eye for an eye or whatever, right? So it's not necessarily deontological, I think, because it's still in response to the law broken. It's committing the crime, at least in that code. So in that viewpoint, the problem isn't necessarily what was done. It's still what was done wrong, but it's reacted in such a way that where justice is not, I think, fundamentally met, right? You know, committing a crime with a crime. And that can go back to, you know, our modern day with capital punishment, and if that's actually justice, but I don't know.
Well, some people think it's just, it comes under the definition of justice in the fact that you're dealing with somebody who broke the law. So how do you reward or punish them for breaking the law?
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, it's by what standards would you do that? So a person saying, you know, using capital punishment to kill someone who, let's say, killed a bunch of people. What effect is that? Like, what's the effect of that? Are you killing them because they might do more, or are you killing them because what they did is so wrong?
Yeah.
And by what standards is it so wrong?
That would be, I guess, under the code of Hammurabi, it would fall under the mala in se.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. then again, it's like, what? I mean, you could tie that into the next value, like faith.
Yeah.
But
how do you? I mean, different cultures. Some cultures don't use capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Other cultures do. And a couple hundred years ago, some what we consider civilized cultures like England would hang people for theft or exile them to Australia.
Also, the guillotine was still used in France until actually very recently.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So another question is, like, say someone is on death row. Execution is bad, we say, right? And I agree, it is. Yeah, because who are you to really decide what is right and wrong? Then again, on the other side, it's like, if you play with fire, you're going to get smoke in your eyes type of mentality. But what's worse, execution or the conditions of waiting for death on death row, which is a whole other situation on its own. It's not like these people are waiting in a Holiday Inn with a nice bed and pillow waiting to go into the electric chair. They're in horrible conditions, so that are just as bad, if not worse, than death.
Well, that goes back to just how individual cultures deal with punishment, deal with transgressors.
Well, I mean, it's true that there's a wide variety of different stances. It's overall relativist, but what you could do, you know, it's much more a rhetorical question, but like, or a rhetorical statement, but you need to view where those values are coming for that culture. So for one culture, it might be a religious perspective, which might not hold that much merit in a logical sense. Or to another person, it might be, okay, we're killing them because they might do more. And then you can question those values. And so I think, you know, on our first morality episode, the one where that was kind of bad.
Yeah.
I think overall, I still, the reason why I think modern day or at least Western types of justice, and when I mean Western, I don't actually mean American, I mostly mean European, but why they're a bit more advanced is they're, I don't know, it's overall thought out of, like, thought through. Like, it's usually rehabilitation instead of punishment, because what does punishment even do? What's the whole purpose of punishment at all, right? If the punishment is to teach someone, that's not really the best way to go about it. If it's to prevent something, there's probably other ways to
do it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it from the behaviorist sense. Punishment is, and punishment could be anything. Anything that reduces the frequency of a behavior.
It doesn't have to be negative.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be bad. Yeah, undesirable.
Well, let's take an example of a piece of great Western literature, Les Misérables. Jean Valjean is imprisoned for stealing a loaf of bread. He gets 5 years for that, and apparently he tried to escape, and they gave him 20 years total. Right, and then he's in parole, where he's never really free. He has to show up at these towns at a certain time and show his parole papers. And if he doesn't, he's on the lam. And that's the premise behind Les Misérables. He goes on the lam. He steals the priest's silver. The priest forgives him, and the police let him go, and he breaks parole. And the repercussions of that. But all he did was steal a loaf of bread. And yet Javert chases him for 20 years until Javert finally has his moment of enlightenment and he commits suicide. I'm not really sure explain why, except he can't reconcile Jean Valjean's goodness with his own duty to serve the law.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what you're saying with law and justice. I think it's also a difference between law and morality. Again, law does not equal morality at all. It's fundamentally not the same thing. I've never read Les Misérables, but that seems clear to me is chasing law, or chasing because of law, or chasing by morality. And for some reason, one example that came to my mind, and like, I don't know why I thought of this, and there may be a historical reason behind this, but like, think of like Napoleon or something, right? Someone who caused so much chaos, right? Again, there's other sides to Napoleon, I suppose, but someone who caused so much chaos and so much destruction for the countries that fought him, right?
As well as his own country.
As well as his own country, right? They didn't kill him. They punished him. They sent him off to exile twice, right? They didn't kill him. There's probably a historical reason for that. It's probably maybe like either to somehow appease the French population. I doubt that was the case, but why they would do that doesn't make any sense for the time period. But if that's an actual historical event, what does that say to a random person committing whatever small crime in the U.S. or whatever and being met by capital punishment, where not even someone like Napoleon would have suffered that?
So let me ask you this question. Do you by that, do you think Napoleon, of course, he caused lots of death, all right, massive amounts, okay? But there are, in his, if I argue his side, I would say that for the first number of years that he was in power, the powers of Europe were trying to restore the monarchy. And even though Napoleon wanted peace with a lot of these powers, they continued to form alliances to defeat him. And at one point, Napoleon himself said, they're not fighting me, they're fighting the revolution.
Yeah. But the thing is, but still, so for example, I actually, overall, I don't have that negative view of Napoleon. Like, I still think it's a negative view, but in the perspective of like Great Britain and all the other powers, it's like, why would you not want to kill this guy kind of thing, especially in that time period, right? Like, you want to reestablish the monarchy, and hell, especially after his return, right? Why would you send him to an island again, right? If he had the ability to come back again, it's far off of this island. But at that point, why would you even keep him alive?
Well, by strict definition, he was a traitor. They could have easily guillotined or hung him as a traitor. He supported the revolution. He was kind of the military right-hand man to Robespierre, with his whiff of gun.
Artillery commander in the
right,
yeah, yeah.
Right. So put down an uprising in Paris, right? But support the revolution.
I have a question. from a listener.
Okay, sure.
Totally good.
So, Justice, we're still on Justice, right?
Yeah, we're on Justice.
Justice is supposed to be blind and fair and balanced, but judges can be bought.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you do about that?
It's funny because, I mean...
The halls of justice are painted green.
Yeah. So it's funny because the way you get around that is through, I suppose, laws. And I'm sure other countries have somehow accomplished a sort of system for that.
Uh-huh.
But it's again, paradoxical in a certain sense where to keep law fair, you use law.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'm sure there is a lot of loopholes by just that definition. Like, okay, who is making those laws to make sure the judge is fine, right? And I'm sure to a certain extent we've gone to a point in history where it's mostly worked out, but absolutely that's absolutely true. And even beyond being bought out, there's always biases of the judge, which is, I mean, even though it's supposed to be as neutral as possible, it's just fundamentally impossible.
Well, take the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
exactly.
I like that expression, fundamentally impossible.
Yeah.
I've got another question.
I have a little poem about it.
Oh, all right. Okay? Yeah.
It's a four-line poem. It's by Langston Hughes, American poet, born in 1902 and died in 1967.
All right.
I should point out that he was Afro-American. It's called Justice. That justice is a blind goddess, is a thing to which we black are wise. Her bandage hides to festering sores that once, perhaps, were eyes.
Excellent. That was cool.
So it was. Is this another question? Yeah.
Yeah, I do have another question from another listener. Question for the podcast. My cousin. This is a little off topic, but I think it's a little on topic because you could tie justice in with politics. Question for the podcast. My cousin is thinking of running for Anchorage mayor as a redneck socialist.
Oh.
Thoughts?
Fully support redneck socialists. We need more of that. Absolutely. Redneck socialists are the most underrated demographic of the United States, in my opinion.
Give me an example of a redneck socialist.
I can't name them, but there was a lady in West Virginia a few years ago who ran and she lost. Absolutely bomb. And there was, what's his name? Odega. He ran for president for like a brief month. Also absolutely amazing. Redneck socialists are some of the... Hell yeah. Do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I would answer that. I can guess what their political views are. And even though I don't agree with them, they have every right.
in this country, they have
every right to run for governor or mayor. That's their prerogative.
So the whole tradition, I think, of that, redneck socialist.
Right.
If you really want to go back that far,
it's a contradiction.
In a certain sense, it is, but it reminds me of, like, you know, people in the South, the hillbillies or whatever, who would fight for the Union or at least against the Confederacy. Like the people in West Virginia, the whole reason for West Virginia splitting. I'm not too sure on the details of that thing, but I feel like it can trace his legacy to that to a certain extent. And I don't know, it's great because I do think there's a sort of elitism that does exist within the cities and the urban lefties out there. And to have a redneck socialist, a local guy who understands, like, you know, old school labor kind of politics and who can advocate for socialism or whatever, absolutely, that's great. And to me, that's to me is actually much more American than, like, for example, I do like the South, I suppose, a lot. But
you lived in the South, right?
Right? But I think the traditions of the South combined with leftism is some of the most American stuff you can get. So
really,
I think so. Yeah, because not overall.
That's an interesting spin on American politics.
I mean, the whole idea of, like, I suppose in a romantic sense of America combined with the old school farmer Southerner. You know, and just that outback kind of person combined with the actual, like, you know, old school progressivism in, like, the early 1900s or whatever. It's just it just screams that to me.
Doesn't that moniker redneck just, it's a wonderful image, isn't it?
Redneck.
And it conjures up so many, you know, getting back to the roots of the earth. You know, they're out in the sun all day, they're working in the field, right? It's a really, it's one of the wonderful monikers in politics.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even like, let's go back to the Revolutionary War, man. Like, I mean, come on. Like, the whole tradition of, like, communalism from, like, the colonies combined with, like, just the whole, just the, you know, the agrarian society is just overall so perfect for this country. So whoever that is, go for it.
And then tie in injustice.
Yeah.
You know, they felt they were treated unjustly.
Yeah.
I don't think they really were, honestly. I think the revolution was, I'm glad it happened, but I think it was highly fabricated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our listener says, my cousin is brilliant and would love Ashok.
Oh, man, dude. I'll tell him that I love him too, man.
Ashok is going to be in his mayoral cabinet.
Oh, man, please. Considering that I'm borderline a redneck socialist myself. I wouldn't consider myself redneck, but I did live in the South for a little bit. And I was considered a socialist.
He's got
so,
the twang.
Yeah.
Although he does have a very white neck.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Oh, man.
So, Sean, do you have another poem?
I actually do. For justice, this is a little bit longer. And I think this gives two sides of justice. Okay, it's from Idols of the King by Alfred Lord Tennyson, who was born in 1809 and died in 1892. Idols of the King is Alfred Lord Tennyson's take on the Arthurian legend. And this, it's about 10 books or 12 books long. When I say books, it's chapters, but it's in the, they use books for epics. And in this scene, it's toward the end of the epic, Arthur is bidding farewell to Guinevere. She has already committed her sin. She's now in a nunnery. And Arthur is on his way to his last battle with Mordred, right, where he will receive his grievous and mortal wound. And Arthur knows he cannot take Guinevere back, but yet he forgives her. So there's two sides of justice here. He knows what he has to do as king, not taking his wife back, because that would be a bad example. But he also wants to forgive her. So if this takes size goes on for a little more than
tucked.
A page. So if you don't mind, I can.
No, of
right?
course.
I think it'll. So Arthur speaks to Guinevere. And she, I should point out that she is face down on the ground in front of him. Not that he ordered it to be so, but she is so shamed by what she has done. For think not, though thou wouldst not love thy Lord has wholly lost his love for thee. I am not made of so slight elements. Yet must I leave thee, woman, to thy shame. I hold that man the worst of public foes, who either for his own or children's sake, to save his blood from scandal, lets the wife whom he knows false abide and rule the house. For being through his cowardice allowed her station, taken everywhere for pure, she, like a new disease unknown to men, creeps, no precaution used, among the crowd, makes wicked lightnings of her eyes, and saps the fealty of our friends, and stirs the pulse with devil's leaps, and poisons half the young, worst of the worst were that man, he that reigns. Better the king's waste hearth and aching heart, Then thou receded in thy place of light, the mockery of my people and their bane. He paused, and in the pause she crept an inch nearer, and laid her hands about his feet. Far off a solitary trumpet blew. Then waiting by the doors, the war horse neighed at a friend's voice, and he spake again. Yet think not that I come to urge thy crimes. I did not come to curse thee, Guinevere. I, whose vast pity almost makes me die, to see thee laying there, thy golden head, my pride in happier summers at my feet. The wrath which forced my thoughts on that fierce law, the doom of treason and the flaming death, when first I learned thee hidden here, is past. the pang which while I weighed thy heart with one, too wholly true to dream on truth in thee, made my tears burn, is also past in part. And all is past, the sin is sin, and I, lo, I forgive thee, as eternal God forgives. Do thou for thine own soul the rest. But how to take last leave of all I loved? O golden hair with which I used to play, not knowing, O imperial molded form and beauty such as never woman wore, until it became a kingdom's curse with thee. I cannot touch thy lips, they are not mine, but Lancelot's. Nay, they never were the king's. I cannot take thy hand, that too is flesh, and in the flesh thou hast sinned. And mine own flesh, here looking down on thee, pollutes, cries, I loathe thee. Yet not less, O Guinevere, for I was ever a virgin save for thee. My love through flesh hath wrought into my life so far that my doom is, I love thee still. Let no man dream but that I love thee still. Perchance, and so thy purify thy soul, and so thou lean on our fair Father Christ. Hereafter in that world where all are pure, we two may meet before high God, and thou wilt spring to me and claim me thine, and know I am thine husband, not a smaller soul, not Lancelot, not another. Leave me that, I charge thee, my last hope. Now must I hence, through the thick night, I hear the trumpet blow. They summon me, their king, to lead mine host far down to that great battle where I must strike against the man they call my sister's son, no kin of mine, who leagues with lords of the white horse, heathen and knights, traitors, and strike him dead and meet myself death, or I know not what mysterious doom. And thou, remaining here, wilt learn the event, but hither shalt I never come again, never lie by thy side, see thee no more. Farewell.
Hallelujah.
All right.
We're back.
We are back.
We're going to be hitting our final value, right?
Some call it a value, yeah.
Yeah. Oh. That's big. Yeah, for people, yeah. For the Arthos and I crew, it might not be such a value, but...
Kind of, yeah.
I think it shouldn't be overlooked.
No, I was just being funny.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a value.
Yeah. Well, this was supposed to be our bonus value, but turned to, you know, to our sixth value. Faith. How intrinsic is it to humanity? What's as important... by the way, we didn't actually talk about Justice's origin, but I think we've kind of covered it with...
Oh, yeah, we talked about Bentham.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Well, that's utilitarianism, but it has a huge part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the origins of justice. Do we want to cover that real quick?
I think just in short, it's kind of like the evolutionary drive of humans to just want to do right and need to be right, too, in your own opinion, I guess.
I think we can also think of justice as getting back to community.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form, it's a means or a tool. A tool's probably a better term. A tool by which the community agrees to act and judge those who go against the laws of the community.
Mm-hmm.
They establish laws, they establish laws to perpetuate the community, and so we'll live largely in peace. Right? I'm not talking about peace with enemies, but peace within the community. And those who abuse those laws, justice deals with them to keep that peace within the community.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would just add that, I would say morality probably is can definitely have a good argument of it being much more intrinsic. But I think justice is overall a social experiment or a social construct in a certain sense. But yeah, I think we're good to move on to faith, I think, right? So origins of faith.
I think you should start this one.
Origins of faith?
Yes.
Oh man.
Do we have a definition of faith? Do you think?
I can pull one up.
Yeah, let's just pull a dictionary definition. I think. I mean, it's kind of hard because we were talking about this earlier with on our breaks and stuff, and it's like, you know, it's not necessarily just a belief. It's not evidence based. It's, I would say, also. Passionately driven, and it's very devotional in a certain sense. I think a good word to use is trust. With faith is a certain sense of trust. But
Webster Dictionary says faith, allegiance to duty or a person, loyalty. Fidelity to one's promises, sincerity of intentions, belief and trust and loyalty to God, and belief in the traditional doctrines of a religion.
I think the final few ones were...
And then, sorry, one more. Firm belief in something for which there is no proof.
I think all three of the last ones were pretty much.
I think so too. Yeah.
Going for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's obviously other earth types of phrase. And
if I told you that I believe in the great God Pan, right? There's no way I can prove that. I'm not sure there's any way you can disprove that.
Well, that's a whole fallacy, though, right? That's the whole teapot around the planet fallacy. I can't disprove there's a teapot around the planet, but I'm not going to claim there's a teapot around the planet, right?
Yes. Right.
It's a responsibility. It's actually very similar to last night's messenger audience kind of thing. It's the responsibility of the person who claims their belief to actually go for it, I would say.
You know, but if I said I believe in God, people would just nod their heads. But the fact that I say the great God Pan, that makes the huge difference.
Yeah. Well, I think the simple answer is just basically our the culture nowadays is just much different than before. I wouldn't even say we're living in a monotheistic culture anymore, but we're in a monotheistic/atheistic side nowadays. We're still certainly not in a polytheistic sense.
Unless you live in India.
Yeah, unless there, yeah. But even for them, it's you usually do consider personalizing one god or the other, but it's yeah, still much more overall polytheistic. But the origins of faith, I mean, again, the academic answer is just, you know, you had family members die, you have burial, you have rituals with burying them underground, and overall you slowly build a sort of, also with like ancestors and whatnot, you slowly build a sort of tradition, and it outcomes a sort of quasi-religion, and then once you get into cities and whatnot, you have like your priests and whatnot, and that, and then you have the whole order, and then you now you have a sort of, you know, central role of faith, right? That's the academic answer. But beyond that, it's faith in a religious sense, I think does fit in that. But I think there's a certain thing of faith that is intrinsic. And I think it actually goes with pride in a certain sense, or at least in a sort of individualistic, tribalistic sense. It's just, you will, it's hard to word this, like evidence-based systems is not what humans always go for, right? There, even, it doesn't have to be religion, but a lot of the times we will just go for what we just want or what we just want to believe. That can go
wisdom.
Huh?
I think wisdom could be like wisdom. Human wisdom isn't always right.
Oh no,
scientifically,
it's not.
But it's intuitive, I guess.
Yeah.
What do you think of the idea of faith going back to its origins? As the need of the human to understand the world and find meaning in it. Because if I just take the natural elements as just natural elements, there's really no meaning in that. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know the science of and of course, you know, prehistoric man did not. If I don't know the science of meteorology or geology, plate tectonics, and an earthquake occurs, I have no idea where that came from,
mm-hmm.
right? Do I attribute it to some power beyond myself? Some conscious power, not just some natural power, but some conscious power. And when you look at the earliest mythologies, they're mostly just natural forces. There'd be a god of fire, god of wind, but they're really not anthropomorphized. They're just the wind. But there's a consciousness attached to the wind, attached to fire, attached to floods. And if I believe there's a consciousness attached to that, then there's a consciousness that I can appease to make the storm stop, to make the earthquake stop. And that might be the origins. That might be, I emphasize big capital letters, italicized. It might be the origins of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you actually hit on two theories of religion. So I did a brief test on religion and whatnot, and I had to study basically, and there were five major theories about the origins of religion, right? And you hit on two of them. So I believe one of the people who had a stance on religion in a major sense was Kant, and his thing was it's a attempt to understand the ununderstandable, right? But in terms of actually controlling that nature, I forget who it was, but it was a different theory. It was basically talking about how religion's origins really lie at controlling that nature, not only just understanding it, but manipulating it. And again, in a sense of like your tribal communities and whatnot, it's probably going to be some sort of dance or some sort of ritual, but
or giving cult.
But of course, I would also say there's other theories I think are also just as valid, at least to a certain extent. Like, you know, at least once we get into the cities, you know, the role of the priest did play a much larger role, and there was probably a much more selfish reason in that sense too of organized religion.
Well, the priests in many ancient societies had tremendous power.
Yeah.
Or even before that, the priestess.
Yeah.
That the cult of the goddess permeated a lot of Paleolithic societies.
The whole mother goddess stuff and the Minoan civilizations.
Right.
Those statues and whatnot. And also with Hinduism, you know, like the whole thing with the priests, you know, the top of the chain at the top of the caste system is the priest, you know, right. The Brahman. But again, so that faith aspect though of how deep it goes, I do think it's important to distinguish between religious faith and just overall like an emotional faith, right? Because I think emotional faith is really it that does go older and that might be much more intrinsic. I mean, overall, emotional faith, the way of pathos or whatever, it's it's counter to logic and it's counter to reason. And if we, you know, if we consider our ancestors, and let's say, you know, you're at your war with a different tribe of apes or whatever, like, you're not really going to think of it in a logical sense. You're just going to be mad at them, and you're going to believe that they stole like a nut from you, and you're going to go to war with them. So I think that that idea of that emotional just drive and just, I believe it because I believe it, I don't care if there's no evidence, I think that's really deep. And I think that's, you know.
Can I read a Nietzsche quote?
Please.
All right. I don't know. So every time, all right, Nietzsche is dangerous to read, man, because he just gets you going.
Great writer.
I think this may make some sense to this conversation. Doubt as sin. Christianity has done its utmost. I love how he just starts it with Christianity, but I think this can. Let's just substitute Christianity for faith here. Christianity has done its utmost to close the circle and declared even doubt to be sin. One is supposed to be cast into belief without reason by a miracle, and from then on to swim in it as in the brightest and least ambiguous of elements. Even a glance towards land, even the thought that one perhaps exists for something else as well as swimming, even the slightest impulse of our amphibious nature is sin. And notice that all this means that the foundation of belief and all reflection on its origin is likewise excluded as sinful. What is wanted are blindness and intoxication and an eternal song over the waves in which reason has drowned.
I have a slight problem with that. Right. So I agree with it all, really.
Really?
But I do to a certain extent, but I think the negativity is a little bit misplaced considering other Nietzsche's positions,
yeah.
Right? So considering that what he did, I'm not the biggest Nietzsche fan, but like...
Yeah, he's a little bit theatrical.
Yeah, I think I agree. But I think, like, for example, like he would state that I suppose a much more natural stance for a human being is something that's un-Christian, right? The whole thing is like, okay, Christianity... you know, subverts the actual values of a person, right? So like, so, you know, supremacy is not actually a value anymore, even though that's supposed to be a human value. But I saying, you know, the fundamental problems that he pointed out with Christianity, which I still think are true, I think those are more fundamental. Those are probably fundamental values of humanity. I think so. Yeah. I think that he's, although I
so
agree
let's
to,
see,
yeah.
in a, as a fundamental value, of Christianity that he's mentioning here would be one is supposed to be cast into belief without reason. Doubt is
doubt. Like I suppose it's not believing anything and sticking to your beliefs, and that's sort of like powerful doubt, I suppose. I think that's very natural for humans.
Is it really a natural feeling, or that it's been brought upon others that control us?
Like
Hammurabi.
Well, that's different, though. See, that's different. I don't think it's fair, as much as I despise Christianity, I don't think it's fair to attribute it to just Christianity.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's fair to attribute it to just Christianity. That's why I kind of said we can attribute this to most faith. That almost is.
But I don't even think it's just faith, though. Because, like, even...
Religion.
How it could be sort of... So what I was thinking of, like, is like, your powerful military leader, your powerful king or whatever who declares something and you must believe it because of whatever. It's not religion, but in a certain sense, it is similar in a sense. It's faith-based.
So as an example, you might say Germany having faith in Hitler to deliver them.
Actually, I'm really glad you mentioned Germany and Third Reich and everything, because their entire thing, I mean, that goes to a whole different conversation about fascism. It's quasi-religious.
It's based on mythology.
It's based on mythology. Right. It's the whole pathos appeal. Mm-hmm. So there, I think that's very interesting to humanity. I think it's a bad part of humanity. But I guess it being bad is a whole different question. But I don't know. I mean, that's a good one, but I don't know if I completely agree.
I just thought it was funny.
It was funny, yeah.
It strikes me as being quite cynical.
Angry.
Yeah, angry.
I mean, that's why I led that with Nietzsche is dangerous to read, because he can get you, you know, really
So let me counter that with a poem.
Okay.
Okay, it's a short poem.
Let's do it.
It's by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was born in 1844 and died far too young in 1889. It's called God's Grandeur. I should give you a little biographical information of Hopkins. He was born in England. He was born Anglican. He converted to Catholicism, became a priest. Some people say if he didn't write poetry, he would have been declared a saint.
Does that mean it's a sin to write poetry?
No, it doesn't, no. But he took some time to write poetry, which, you know, took some other, took from other more holy endeavors, shall we say? But I find his poetry quite moving, even though I'm not a believer. Okay, mm-hmm. I don't share his faith, but I find his faith quite intoxicating. And he gives a very positive view of faith as something very personal, as opposed to trying to manipulate others. And I think it's faith in its purest, most beautiful sense. And I should also point out that this poem is also very ecological. Long before ecology even became a term. It's called God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not speak his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge, shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and though the last lights off the black west went, O morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings.
All right. False alarm. That was awesome.
That was good.
I like that one. I think you might have read that one recently to us.
Maybe.
Maybe not on the show, but I remember that the last few lines from that are one of my favorites. Or some of my favorites, I mean.
I'll claim he's one of my favorite poets. He's very difficult, but he's one of my favorite poets.
I like it.
I also like
that shorter one that you read earlier.
Lex and Hughes one.
Yeah, I definitely want to write that one down.
We did four poems today, right? Four? Three? Four? I think it was four.
I've got lots.
We still have half an hour.
Yeah.
Do you want to do another tune? Do you want to do your song?
Should we say that one for the closer?
Yeah, let's do that for the end. Yeah.
Okay.
It's up to you, but because we can always close with Mozart.
Yeah, I suppose that's tradition.
Just kind of tradition.
Yeah.
It wasn't Mozart that we used to close with, but it was that piece that was on Amadeus.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of tradition to close with.
All right, screw it. False alarm on the false alarm. Let's play the song.
All right.
Okay, so this is back to Atisha here, who was that guy we played last night. This is one of the other songs. I forget the name. It's something about, like, the waiting for an elevator and seeing them realizing our mortality and going for it. I don't know. It's a weird song. All right, false alarm on the false alarm. We'll be right back.
Well, before we go, also...
Well, the first answer would be, it depends on what you mean by Jesus.
What do you mean by that?
Thank you.
We are back. Okay. Hold on. So what were you in the middle of?
I was thought about a scene from Breaking Bad.
Okay.
Should we just...
Yeah, just go with it.
All right, sure. We were just talking about, really quickly, basically at the point where you get to where how do you forgive yourself? We're kind of talking about pride in yourself and faith in yourself, and at that point where you don't know what to do once you've done something so bad. So the scene from Breaking Bad that I was talking about, so I'll start over. This character named Jesse is in a therapy session with a group of people, and he has killed somebody, and he's trying to vent about it, basically. And the reason why he killed this person, I'm not trying to give spoilers, is the guy was no direct threat to him, but he had
spoiler warning.
Yeah, he had to kill him, or he himself would get killed, basically, right? So he kills this guy, and he feels really bad about it. He's never killed anybody before, right? So he's at a therapy session, and the analogy he gives is a dog. And some person asks, was the dog sick? He's like, no, it was just a problem dog. He's like, well, what's wrong with you? Why did you kill the dog? There's nothing wrong with it. It's like, why are you doing that? He didn't bite someone or whatever. So he gets really mad, and then he eventually snaps, right? He's like, he talks about it. And the therapist guy is like, hey, Jesse, you can't keep being yourself over this. You have to move on, right? And Jesse's like, wait, so no matter what I do, no matter what horrible things I do, I just say, oh, I just have to move on because I'm a great guy. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just have to move on. And then reverts back to the therapist who, in the story, he had killed his own daughter. He was high on drugs and he was drunk and he backed out of his basically his driveway while drunk and
he killed his daughter,
right? And he moved on and became a therapist. So Jesse then reverts back to the guy. He's like, what, you moved on? Like, someone like you has moved on? What do you do at that point? So I really like that scene because it's like, well, God damn, he kind of has a point, you know.
Yeah,
like
he pointed out the hypocrisy.
Yeah, like how many times do you have to do something wrong to be like, okay, I can't move on. I'm just bad. And Jesse has a lot of scenes like that in Breaking Bad. It's an earlier scene where he's like, he's talking to the main character Walter, and Walter keeps giving excuses of like why this problem happened, and Jesse's like, Walter, you either keep making excuses or you understand that at the end of the day, you're the bad guy or someone along mm-hmm. those lines.
But isn't there a profound difference between the therapist killing his daughter by accident because he's drunk and on drugs, as opposed to this character, Jesse, is his name? He kills out of self-preservation.
Yeah. Well, it's true, but so it's I guess it's important.
I would say the therapist is in a worse position.
Well, to get clarification on the therapist story, basically the story is that he was, you know, he's always drinking and doing drugs
right.
and stuff. And it's his birthday, and basically he runs out of booze, and he asks his wife, "Hey, can you get some stuff, some booze for me? I'm drunk." And she's like, "No, you drank too much already, and it's late." And he's like, he gets all angry and stuff, and he's, you know, high, and then he accidentally kills his daughter and leaves. So it is accidental.
That is so sad.
It's really sad. But to be fair, if you watch the show, you will understand why Jesse killed that person too.
Mm-hmm.
But even if those, you know, specific examples aren't great, I think the overall question of at what point do you actually, can you not move on? Like if Hitler ever had a realization, for example, or whatever, like what's he going to do? You know, it's just going to be like,
on.
Hey man, I accept myself. Like you, what do you do with the situation?
You can hold on to it. It's kind of like being one with the Tao. I mean, the longer you hold on to activity, or the longer you push against the truth, I guess, in this case, or what you did or what you are, the more it hurts you more than anything. I mean, you know, hiding from the truth, the only person that suffers is you.
Well, that's the thing. So tying back to justice. Wow, what a great rounder. Tying back to justice, when you feel like you deserve that, though. When you feel like I've done so much wrong, that's proper justice at least,
yeah.
Right? I don't know. I don't have a clear position on this, but I don't know. Like
some people don't have a conscience, like clinically.
Oh yeah, that's a whole.
So
yeah.
That's a different situation.
For them, it's, yeah.
So you say you like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, two of your favorite shows, right?
The whole universe is just my favorite.
I've told you before. I'm gonna tell you again. You gotta watch West Wing. Like seriously, one of the best written shows. If you like those shows, you'll fall in love with West Wing. Oh my god, man, it is incredible. Before, and it's before those two shows, but like it was such a groundbreaking show.
West Wing is about the presidents.
Yeah, it's about what's his name? Martin Sheen plays President Bartlett, a really democratic president. Throughout that, and it follows the administration. And for one, you learn a lot when you watch it, and it's extremely well made.
Well, I mean, have you watched Breaking Bad?
I've seen parts and scenes of it, but I haven't watched the entire series.
I think you would like it a lot because Breaking Bad is incredibly symbolic, and it's a lot of psychological elements too. And the interesting thing is, it parallels with Better Call Saul. They're opposites in a certain sense.
Are they related at all?
Oh yeah, Better Call Saul is a prequel to Breaking
Bad. Oh really?
Yeah, so I would recommend watching Breaking Bad first, actually.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's also the movie El Camino, which is a sequel to Breaking Bad.
Okay.
So, but Better Call Saul isn't finished. But I think you would like it. I think both of you would like it too. It's overall just incredibly symbolic. Even the way they use colors in the show. If you pay attention to what the characters wear as the seasons go on and in what situations, it's so good.
That sounds like something Stanley Kubrick does.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like up to that level in my opinion. And for example, if you prefer something more like action paced and eat your popcorn and watch, I would Breaking Bad, you know. But if you want something like a slow burn, like for example, Breaking Bad is like, you know, big event after big event, while Better Call Saul is like lead up big hit. And it's like for example, right now with Better Call Saul, it's like borderline pretty much equally as good as Breaking Bad. And that's something to say. But
I thought Better Call Saul was done with.
Almost. There's one more season left.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but season 5 just finished, or aired, I should say, in May, I think.
Kind of what I would say West Wing is like, because it follows the administration and things in the government move so slow. Yeah. It's like it builds you up, and then you find yourself rooting for this administration, and, you know, because they're portrayed as the virtuous.
Yeah.
Ones, you know, that show was so ahead of its time for American politics. You know, they were making comments on, you know, anti-Islam, you know, rhetoric and how that's wrong, and environmentalism. We're talking early 2000s.
Yeah.
And that show was airing during the Bush administration. So it was like a slap in the face, kind of. But I think you'll like it.
Yeah, when you mentioned when you're rooting, so I'm guessing the administration overall is bad.
No, they're amazing.
Oh, okay.
They're like the ideal political administration. Okay. Seriously, and you find yourself rooting for them.
So what I thought you were saying was you root for them, but they're actually bad.
No, they're amazing.
Okay.
A politically correct administration.
Yeah. Well, they're not actually completely politically correct too, because they do a lot of things that people still see as wrong, and they, that's another thing, is like while this machine of a government is rolling on and it's not stopping, the people in the administration, it shows their personal lives and how they're dealing with their personal lives at the same time. They get into questionable situations.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Have you watched House of Cards?
No, but I wanted to start it because I think it's similar.
Yeah. I watched the first episode too. I was wondering how they compare, but I heard House of Cards.
Did you like it?
What, House of Cards?
Yeah.
Out of the one episode I watched, I thought it was okay.
Have you seen Veep?
No, I know you recommend it to
that
me.
That one is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
But and that one too, it's very educational if you want to learn about, you know, the government. Both those shows, I've noticed, like, I watched them one after the other. I watched Veep in entirety in like a month because it was so hilarious.
Yeah.
With Julia Louis-Dreyfus as the president/vice president. And then West Wing. And I learned in that course of like 6 months so much about the United States government.
I have to take I might be taking a U.S. government test soon. So it's like, I mean, we just watch it.
It's totally great. We have one more poem?
Yeah. Well, how much time we got?
We have 10 minutes left.
How long is the last poem? Do you have a last poem?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, we need to go for a little bit more, I think. Well, I don't know. Any final thoughts about our value? I mean, this is a two-part episode. It's actually kind of big. Overall, 4-hour discussion, really. Any final thoughts on these 6 values or anything more? Any values that you think we missed that we should have covered?
Sorry, Bailey just texted me saying Veep is actually like a satirical spin-off of West Wing. Not officially, But there's a lot of parallelism there.
I guess watch West Wing
I
want to
let you know. Yeah, watch West Wing first.
And then, okay. Get to know. Wait, any final thoughts or anything?
Final thoughts.
For Six Values and whatever?
I think what we were talking about during the song was pride I think it's portrayed as a undesirable value sometimes. That's why I think I was having so much trouble on yesterday's episode trying to identify what I'm proud of, I guess. But over, you know, some thought, I've realized that it's I am proud of some things. Yeah. That's my final thought.
Yeah.
For anyone else having a similar issue.
If I had a final thought, it would be that all that we discussed, all those various moods and states of mind, that they have both they can be beneficial, but they can also be detrimental. In some cases, taken to extreme, like pride,
mm-hmm.
or extremist faith, when it becomes militant. So they all have their pluses and minuses. And it comes down to the individual and how they balance those various parts of those.
This is starting to sound really like Aristotelian virtue ethics.
Yeah, I think it does, yeah.
Well, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to individual, virtue.
I suppose added another philosophical thing. I think all these values can overall be somewhat controlled by a sense of reason. I mean, reason is one of the biggest things that the early modern philosophers were all about. It was almost a worship of reason. And with each one, to a certain extent, we can understand the detriments of it and somehow to mitigate those detriments, I think I suppose the one value that we missed that I think we should cover later, and I still think we should revisit pride, by the way, but I think it's reason. I think reason is something we take for granted, and sometimes we may use too much sometimes. And like, for example, I think overall analyzing faith with reason is difficult, but nonetheless, you doing that also benefits faith. But yeah, I think just for now, I think we covered six values. For the future, we may add some more. Next episode hopefully should be about mythology. I suppose a good leading on from faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess before we end on the night, guys, we're going to come with our final poem for the night, fourth or fifth poem. What we got?
We have another excerpt from The Idylls of the King by Tennyson. This is the last couple pages of that work. And so let me set the scene. The battle that Arthur was going to in the previous poem has taken place. Arthur has been mortally wounded. Everybody is dead, but Sir Bedivere, his last surviving knight, and King Arthur. And Bedivere has disposed of the blade Excalibur as Arthur ordered. It's been retrieved by the Lady of the Lake. And so then Bedivere carries Arthur, again, mortally wounded, to where the three ladies take him in their barge to take him to Avalon. And so Bedivere has placed him in the barge, and he calls from the shore as Arthur lays in the barge. Then loudly cried the bold Sir Bedivere, "Ah, my lord Arthur, whither shall I go? Where shall I hide my forehead and my eyes? For now I see the true old times are dead, when every morning brought a noble chance, and every chance brought out a noble knight. Such times have not since the light that led the holy elders with the gift of myrrh. But now the whole round table is dissolved, which was an image of the mighty world, and I, the last, go forth companionless. And the days darken round me, and the years among new men, strange faces, other minds." And slowly answered Arthur from the barge, "The old order changeth, yielding place to new, and God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. Comfort thyself, what comfort is in me. I have lived my life, and that which I have done, may he within himself make pure. But thou, if thou shouldst never see my face again, pray for my soul. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. Wherefore, let thy voice rise like a fountain for me night and day. For what are men better than sheep or goats that nourish a blind life within the brain, if, knowing God, they lift not their hands of prayer both for themselves and those who call them friend? For so the whole round earth is every way bound by gold chains about the feet of God. But now, farewell. I am going a long way with these thou seest, if indeed I go, for all my mind is clouded with a doubt, to the island valley of Avalon, where falls not hail or rain or any snow, nor ever wind blows loudly, but it lies deep-meadowed, happy, fair with orchard lawns, and bowery hollows crowned with summer sea, where I will heal me of my grievous wounds. So said he, and the barge, with oar and sail, moved from the brink like some full-breasted swan that, fluting a wild carol ere her death, ruffles her pure cold plume and takes the flood with swarthy webs. Long stood Sir Bedivere, revolving many memories, till the hull looked one black dot against the verge of dawn, and on the mare, the wailing died away.